This program brought to you by Vanderbilt University. You can find more audio and video on our website, vanderbilt.edu/news.
I'm Nancy Reisman. I'm on the faculty in creative writing here at Vanderbilt, and it's a particular honor for me to introduce our guest Patrick O'Keefe tonight. Before we get started, I'd like to take a moment to thank the Department of English and the Gertrude and Harold S. Vanderbilt funding. Margaret Quigley and Meredith Gray, thank you, Meredith, for their help with tonight's events. The next reading in our series will be Thursday, February 19th, here in Buttrick. I think it's Buttrick 102, is it? It's either 102 or 101. A reading by poet Maggie Anderson. And if I've got it right, Friday, February 20th at 4 p.m., there will be a group reading by the first-year poets and fiction writers in our MFA program. And both of these promise to be really wonderful events. So we'll have more information forthcoming and hope you all can be there. I would like to remind you all to take a minute to turn off your cell phones. And also, if you could refrain from text messaging until after the reading is over, that'd be great. What else? After the reading, we have books for sale. Patrick O'Keefe's book, The Hill Road, and he is happy to sign them. So stick around afterwards. We'll have a little bit of time to talk, and we'll have those books for sale. The graduate school that I went to had a very large MFA program. And one year, during the warmer months, the MFA students played softball. Poets versus fiction writers. One of the poets, a very gifted, irreverent writer named Frances Dowell, some of you have met her, was the poetry team's catcher, and she liked to harass the fiction writer batters and try to psych them out. She'd pick the names of well-known fiction writers she found to be overrated or artistically discredited. I'm not going to mention any names. And just as the batter would swing, she'd mutter the equivalent of, "Richard Nixon is a fiction writer." Frances was also my roommate, and I knew how headstrong she could be. And we needed her, and I have to say, I was just moral support for the fiction writing squad. But it was clear at some point that we needed her to stop psyching out the batters, and we were having a hard time getting her off message. And we needed to be a lot smarter or craftier than we were. What we actually needed was Patrick O'Keefe and his extraordinary book, The Hill Road. Fiction so attuned to voice, to the rhythms of language, so lyrically and dramatically complex, so emotionally acute, and at moments so heart-stopping, that any serious, gifted, irreverent poet worth her salt would forget about everything but those pages. This has been the case for many of O'Keefe's readers, and the reason The Hill Road won the prestigious Story Award, a Story Prize, and the Distinguished Writing Writers Award. Before the book was a book, O'Keefe's work earned the Hopwood Award from the University of Michigan, where he got his MFA. And I don't think there was a softball team there. Softball teams there. Patrick O'Keefe was born in Ireland and grew up there and moved to the States and went to school here and stayed. And he now teaches creative writing at Colgate University. And luckily for the fiction writers on the team those years ago, we had a few writers who'd been good high school athletes. And luckily for the reading community, Frances Dowell now writes both fiction and poetry. And luckily for us, Patrick is here with us tonight. Please welcome him.
Thank you. Thank you for being here, and thanks to Nancy and Rick for inviting me. It's been a pleasure. It's been a great day. I'm going to read from something new I've been working on, and the working title is The Moon in Cancer, and I'm going to read from the second part of the piece. I think it's longer than a short story. That's all I know about it for now. But I don't like doing this, but just to give you a little bit of background, perhaps, just to give you some sense of the narrative. But just to briefly summarize what has happened in the piece, a homeless man named Walter, whom the narrator, who's unnamed here, knows by sight, knocks on the narrator's screen door one summer's night, frantic about an elderly woman that's supposedly lying on the street. The speaker lives in an apartment at the back of a house, probably in a town in the Midwest, in the US or Upper South. And both the speaker and Walter walk out onto the street, but there is no elderly woman, which makes the speaker think Walter, of course, is lying. Also, an elderly woman lives on the narrator's street, but he only knows her to see. But that's all. I'll just go ahead and read it. Okay, thank you. I hope it makes more sense than what I just said there. Okay, let's put it that way. Okay. How strange that night was, and I woke late the next morning with Michael Fitzgerald on my mind. When I was a child, he wore a white starch work shirt, blue overalls, and sat in the armchair across the range from my father. I hadn't thought about Michael sitting there in years, or the perfect hollow his broad backside left in the cushion of that wobbly armchair, which once belonged to an aunt on my mother's side. I was once in love with Michael's daughter. It started when I was 11, and it continued for many years. I got out of bed, I brushed my teeth, then I was sitting in my chair. I had my clothes on, but I didn't have my shoes on. I had picked up a book from one of the piles on the floor and was reading sentences I had underlined in pencil. I drank coffee and I smoked. Then I had propped open the screen door and was standing in the doorway, shaking out the cushion Walter had sat on. I came away from the door and moved the three stacks of books off of the small rug at the foot of the bed and returned to the door to shake the rug out. The cloud of dust against the sharp, hot sunlight made me think of sandstorms you see in every desert movie. But there I was, shaking out the rug, turning my face away from the dust, while shouting merry obscenities at the squirrels who bolted around the yard and up and down the tree trunks. I dropped the rug onto the floor, gently kicked it into place, put the three stacks of books on it, and sat on the edge of the bed, wondering what I might do next. I ended up sweeping the floor and changing the bed sheets. The pile of delf in the sink would wait, though I did empty Walter's cigarette butts from the saucer into the garbage bin, and I turned off the radio, put my shoes on, and headed out to buy the local newspaper. I wanted to see if there was any word about the elderly woman Walter had seen lying in the street in her bathrobe, wearing white sneakers. When I bought the paper, I headed toward the post office. I believed I was hoping I'd run into Walter. Business-looking women and men in short sleeves, postal workers and construction workers, were gathered around a hot dog stand down the steps from the post office. I stalled in the pleasant stream of smoke. Then the renegade skateboarders forced me forward. Walter was not sitting on the homeless bench. One man sitting there walked beside me and asked me for bus fare money to a place I had never heard of. His hair was braided like Willie Nelson's, but the homeless man's braids were not so tidy. I eventually handed him a cigarette, and 15 minutes later, I was sitting on the slatted wooden bench in the shade of the two weeping willows that grew outside the new glassy law school building. I listened to the whir of the leaves before I opened the newspaper to the local news. A man had jumped from a parking structure onto the street. Students caught snorting cocaine. Two single mothers busted for selling some other kind of drug. A soldier home from the war pistol-whipped his wife, then shot at a neighbor who intervened. And no word about a wandering elderly woman. I left the newspaper under a stone on the bench and headed for the Amtrak station and the river. It was a warm afternoon, but not too warm, which suited me. The four streets I walked down were blissfully quiet, which likewise suited me. Blossoming tiger lilies bent toward me at the edges of lawns. At a stoplight, I was circled by 7 or 8 singing Dare Care children, tethered to one another at the wrist like a chain gang. Then I was leaning over the railway bridge. The shadows of leaves were dark and still on the sunlit red brick wall of the empty platform. My cigarette ash floated onto the tracks that ran east to Chicago. The sucking of the river, and Michael Fitzgerald was there. The morning he died was. Michael was a neighbor, good friends with my parents, and when he sat in that armchair across the range from my father, he told my father dirty jokes. Those jokes were never direct. Hole usually rhymed with pole, and on one occasion, hole with coal. My mother pretended to not hear those jokes when she lifted the teapot from the range to fill the mince tea mugs. She didn't listen when she spooned sugar into the mince mugs and added milk into each mug. Then, holding the milk jug high in her right hand, she rapidly stirred each mug with a spoon she kept in her apron pocket. A male neighbor walked across the fields to tell us about Michael's death. I recalled the reluctant tap of his knuckles on our open door, though the man's name I don't recall. It was a Saturday morning in late June, during breakfast time, so between 9 and 10. My father was back from the creamery. He sat in his armchair to the left of the range and read the newspaper. He did this every morning, as long as I knew him, no matter what work was pressing. For 50 minutes he hid behind that newspaper, and every minute or so his hand crept from behind it and his bent finger, broken the year he worked on building sites in Northampton in England, tipped the cigarette ash onto the blackened top of the white range. I sat in the at the kitchen table with my 2 brothers. A fly swooned above the open marmalade jar. A knife was sticking out of the jar. One of my sisters stood before the sink and washed Delph in the red plastic basin. She had tied her hair back and pushed the sleeves of her blue cardigan above her elbows. Another sister brought plates of food to the table that my mother had handed her at the cooker, while another filled the teapot and cut homemade bread on the breadboard. My mother was frying eggs. She pressed a spatula down hard on each egg and shouted at me and my 2 older brothers who were sitting at the table to stop complaining, for even if the undercooked or overcooked egg was not to our liking, any kind of egg was better than no egg. Seconds before the tap of knuckles on the door, the 2 dogs barked in a way that warns you a stranger has entered the yard. My mother immediately dropped the spatula and dashed down the short hall to greet the neighbor. And before she led the neighbor in, she shouted at the dogs to pipe down. And when the neighbor was in, she asked him to sit in the chair across the range from my father, the chair where Michael Fitzgerald sat. But the neighbor didn't stir. He stood close to me at the table, pressing his balled-up cap from one hand to the other, and when he bit down on his bottom lip, his cheeks reddened and his eyes darted from the floor at his feet to my father and next to my mother, who stood beside him. Her eyes had that look that knew this man was not bearing pleasant news. "Hello, God bless," he eventually spoke. "Lovely weather. Hello to all the lads. But sorry to have to stop by. Sorry to have to stop by at such an awkward time of the day, and sorry to have to be the one with the news, but God rest him, Michael Fitz is gone from us. He is indeed gone." Michael and Alma Fitzgerald had 4 children. Their youngest boy at this time was an infant, and those of us attending national school went there with our 2 other boys, who were identical twins and were a few years behind me in the other schoolroom, the one known as the baby's room. The Fitzgerald's eldest was Sarah. She's 4 years older than me, and at the time of her father's death was a second-year student at the De La Salle Brothers and Convent School, which was about 12 miles from where we lived. Sarah took the red double-decker bus there, the same bus my 2 sisters and my 2 brothers took. I would board that bus the following year. I longed to hear Sarah's father's dirty jokes, his bold laugh at every punchline when he gripped his knees and his John Garfield curl slid down his forehead and Michael's hand shot up to gently finger that curl back to its proper place. The look on my father's face when Michael was telling those jokes was somewhere between embarrassment and anticipation, the arched eyebrows, the sucked-in lips, until the punchline, when a smile flared at the corner of my father's mouth. It flared for seconds only, like something you never trust you saw, something out of the corner of your eye falling down the sky in a dark night. Maybe my father smiled to please a neighbour. They were all polite in that way. Or maybe my father did find those jokes funny. My mother's concern was that her children would detect what those jokes were really about. So if Michael told more than one, and he mostly did, so at least I had one, she sent us all outside, except for my second eldest sister, the one who wore the blue cardigan, whom my mother kept indoors to watch my baby brother. Let me just sit here. Excuse me. Two nights after Walter first appeared, around 8:30, the light in the room changed gloomy, and leaves rattled in the trees at the edge of the yard. I had heard on the radio earlier that a storm was imminent, and I switched on the tree lamps, shut both windows, walked onto the sidewalk, and stood in the shade of the maple. A couple across the way jumped out of their porch swing and darted indoors. A torn peace sign sailed by a few inches above the street. When it started to rain, I went inside and stood at the screen door. The rain piled over the doorway ledge. I turned away from the rain and put in a CD. Then I was standing before the sink, rolling my sleeves up. With the pissing rain and the music, I didn't hear Walter's feet on the gravel, and I don't know if he knocked or how long he had stood watching in, waiting for me to turn from the sink. I finished the wash-up and saw the shape at the screen. It startled me, though I knew it was Walter, and I crossed the room, switched the outside light on, unhasped the screen door, and asked him to come out of the rain that was dripping from his flattened grey hair and tin green windbreaker with a faded logo on the left breast pocket, the kind of windbreaker American football coaches wore in the 70s, so I think. He stood inside the door and asked if I minded him stopping by. I said if I did, I wouldn't have asked him to come in, and I asked as to why he was not wearing his baseball cap. Never wear it when it's raining, he said. Don't want it getting wet. In a light-hearted way, I inquired if he had come across any elderly women lying in the street. He eased a knapsack from his right shoulder, saying he didn't see anyone. I was gathering up clothes from the chair, and I opened the wardrobe door and flung the clothes in. I told Walter to sit down and went to the bathroom to get him a towel. He dropped the towel fully over his head the way a boxer or a basketball player might and waited a few moments before he began to vigorously dry his hair. When he was done, he draped the towel around his shoulders like a prayer shawl. I asked if he wanted to take the windbreaker off. He said no. I next asked if he would like to take his shoes off. No, again, if it was okay with me. I told him I didn't give a damn. I was only asking for the sake of politeness. He wore the shoes he always wore, wrinkled dress shoes with the lips undone, but the soles looked firm. There were laces in two rows of eyes. I handed him a cigarette, the lighter, the wash saucer. I felt oddly gallant. He lit the cigarette, said grateful, and said he was in the library earlier, but one man working there, who never liked him, had asked him to leave. So he went to the park and lay under the trees in a quiet place and fell asleep. The rain in the trees woke him, and he was only wearing a t-shirt. It had been hot in the afternoon, and he sat up and remembered he'd left a shirt on the back of the chair in the library. The man who didn't like him would have thrown it out by now. I was filling the coffee pot with water and said that losing things was always a nuisance. I dropped the bread into the toaster and asked if he liked marmalade. He said the orange stuff was cool. I made a stupid remark about golden oranges ripening in the Florida sun and followed that with a stupid remark about warm blue water, white beaches, and gorgeous sunbathers in Miami. I was thinking he might say something about his home state, He didn't. He asked me how I was. Good moments, strange moments, Walter, I said. You know the way the days go. I did tell him I'd put in my few hours at the bakery earlier and had the rest of the day to myself, which suited me like nobody's business. I said I took long walks around the town. I went about living and studying in a lackadaisical fashion. I was opening a beer, about to mention I had looked for him at the post office a few days ago when a clap of thunder shook the screen door. The lights blinked off, then on. The music stalled, the toaster popped. Walter and I were both watching the screen door, the trapped raindrops in the screen shining for seconds against the dark before they vanished. I poured his coffee and spread marmalade on the toast. He was still watching the door when I laid the coffee and the plate of toast on the floor beside him. He turned his face from the door and picked up the plate and began to eat like he'd done two nights before. I took out the CD and put in another. The rain had stopped, and I pushed out the window to the weary drip from the gutter and the sluggish scent of wet streets and trees. Two fireflies lit up from the grass. A horny cicada groaned. I turned to Walter, picking up the coffee. He sipped, put the cup on the floor, and said he needed a favor. I was sitting by then and told him to fire away. In the next couple of days, he said, he needed a drive about 20 miles west of town, out to the country, and if I would drive him there, he'd find his own way back. He pulled a towel from around his shoulders, slumped, and pressed the towel to his eyes. I slugged a beer and asked how many miles did he say it was, even though I'd heard how many. He repeated the amount. I asked what day it was he'd like to go, day after tomorrow, if he'd work for me. He was sorry to ask. He didn't intend to. I told him not to worry about it. I could drive him when I was finished at the bakery, sometime after 12. I then said I thought his aunt lived in Florida, and he said the aunt close by was his father's sister, so not the aunt who raised him. But his father's sister had called a shelter this past week. She was old and didn't drive anymore. Walter and she had not seen each other in 10 years. That's a long time, Walter, I said. It's a long time, and no matter how long or short it is, it's none of my business. I said I would bring a friend from the college with me. Charlotte is her name, I said. Walter reached for the coffee cup and said whatever was okay with me was okay with him. I asked how he planned to get back to town. He said his aunt might pay for a cab. If that didn't happen, he'd walk or hitch. I said if I drove him out there, I'd drive him back. I'd do the job correctly. He said if he'd work for me, he'd work for him. He was grateful. I said a drive in the country will do us the world of good. It'll be an adventure, Walter, and I need an adventure, I said, and picked up the beer and said that the delicious smell of baking bread was ugly. Yes, Walter, it was ugly when I stood at the bakery window to watch the sun rising inside the pine trees at the edge of the strip mall. And I looked at mysterious Walter, who was wiping his eyes again, and suggested that he put on dry clothes, because if he became ill, none of us would be driving anywhere. And then I was standing, humming along to the music, swaying to the music, when I opened the wardrobe door to get Walter another towel. I was shutting the door when I saw those shirts. I dropped the towel and pulled the shirts from their hangers. One shirt had a blue boxy pattern that in my mind had been red. The red in the other was lighter than I had remembered. I shut the wardrobe door and told Walter I was heading outside and I'd return with a weather report. I handed him the towel and the shirts. If you don't like the shirts, I told him, you can give them to someone at the shelter or at St. Mary's. He stood and turned his back on me and laid the shirts and the towel on the chair. He picked up his knapsack and unzipped it. I switched on the light, opened the screen door and stepped outside. Lazy lines of rain slipped over the doorway ledge. The demented moths spun around the naked bulb that was shrouded in cobwebs and spotted with the remains and shit of other insects. I blinked at the light, wondering why the moths wearied themselves, but on my walk up the gravel driveway, I was thinking how we are all like that. A branch torn by the wind lay in the middle of the street. I picked up the branch and cast it onto the opposite lawn. Rainwater ran fast and loud in the gullies. There was the smell from the sewer. I waited for a fast car with a dodgy muffler, a pizza sign on its roof, to pass before I crossed over and leaned against a maple. A young woman jogged up the center of the street. She wore a pink baseball cap and skimpy shorts. Then the smell of the sewer was wiped away, and the air smelled oddly like spring again. I lit a cigarette. Sarah Fitzgerald stepped out of the dressing room. Well, it wasn't what you would call a real dressing room. Sarah Fitzgerald came from behind a faded red sheet that was pinned in the corner. The dress she was wearing was made in the 50s or early 60s. Large black sunflowers on the front and back. Do I imagine those flowers were sewn in there later? A low V-shaped back and a wide belt. It was white. No, it wasn't white. It was creamy, lined with the kind of gauze you press onto wounds. She stood before the mirror and ran her hands along the front and back of the dress. She turned left and she turned right. She turned her back to the mirror and glanced over her right shoulder. She made faces like Groucho Marx. Her short hair shone the way her father's did when I was a boy. She asked what I thought about the dress, and I said it was miraculously cool and she should buy it. I'd throw in a few dollars. I had tips from my lunchtime shift in the restaurant. She said the dress was cool, but it was likewise silly, and when would she ever have a chance to wear it? I said she could wear it every day. She could wear it in bed. I didn't mind. There were too many ways to live. She said she would buy the dress if I bought the shirts. I had tried on the shirts and liked them well enough, but I bought the shirts so that she would buy that dress. On the landing of the outbound Harvard Square T, I had gripped her arm and said we should walk. It was a sunny day. We should walk up Mass Ave to Porter Square. A new Spanish restaurant had opened up, and I'd met a couple the week before who worked there. They'd said to stop by. We were good for lunch and Bloody Marys. We turned on the stairs and walked into the crowd. All of the faces looked the same to me. Right before Porter Square, we came upon the consignment store. It was the window display that made us stop. The female mannequin fitted perfectly in a flapper dress, long necklaces draped around the mannequin's long neck, a small hat with long feathers fixed inside the band, the male mannequin in a World War I uniform, the helmet tilted over his forehead, a plastic American cowboy rifle fixed onto his shoulder. In the glass, she folded her arms. I must go back, she said. I have to go back. Christ, let's not talk about going backwards or forwards, I said, and not in a polite way. Let's walk into this shop and buy something, and then we can always say, remember that day on Porter Square we bought that. But there's more to this, like there's always more to this. Like on the walk, the heat of the pavement bore through her sandals and scorched the soles of her feet. But the pavement was cool when we walked by the ivy-covered college wall. We stood for a while with our backs to the wall. We were holding hands. I made a joke about waiting for the firing squad. The South American nannies walked by. They were laughing, leading children home from school. I flicked the cigarette butt into the street, heard the wet slap of the jogger's sneakers, her short, even breath before I saw her. I wished her a good night. She said hi. Then I was in the street, walking next to the parked cars and underneath the gloomy and dripping trees, whose wet leaves were shiny where the beams of the streetlight caught them. I stepped onto the sidewalk in front of the elderly woman's house, then sprinted up the tree steps, across the porch, my face to her front window, hand to my forehead. I saw only darkness. I raised my other hand to knock on the window, but remembered the time. On my way back across the porch, I saw the pair of sneakers behind the footrest. I picked one up by its long lace, like it were a dead fish at the end of a line, and I held it out before me and headed down the steps. I raised the sneaker high in the beam of the streetlight. I did think it was white when I picked it up, but I wanted to make sure. Indeed it was. And then I was opening the screen door to Walter standing attentively next to the chair, the knapsack over his shoulder. He looked ready to go. He had combed his hair back and changed into a faded black and baggy polo. Stiff wisps of his hair sprang over his forehead. In the low lamplight, his cheekbones were purple. I could not see his eyes at all. The CD had stopped. He did not look at me, but nodded when I told him the night was fine, only for rain dripping from the leaves. He said he'd hung up the towels in the bathroom. I said not to worry about the towels. I'll keep the shirts for a special occasion. Grateful, he said, and buttoned up the windbreaker. I appreciate the marmalade, man. You're welcome, man, I said, opening the screen door. He went on through. Them shirts are all yours, I spoke through the shut screen door. I should have given them away 10 or 11 years ago. I stepped forward and pressed my face against the screen. One of the moths sailed away from the light and began to spin madly about his head. Walter coughed, and without facing me, without budging an inch, he loudly spoke. There's something I need to tell you, man. I think I should tell you now. I was watching the moth, then the bulky soiled knapsack, whose original color I could not make out. Need to tell you, should tell you now. I could always put off hearing things coming from a voice like Walter's. And so I said, you can tell Charlotte and me in the car, Walter. It'll give us something to talk about. He didn't say anything, but he waited a moment before he walked off into the dark. I listened to his feet crunching the gravel, and when I didn't hear the gravel anymore, I came away from the door and picked up the saucer of cigarette butts, the plate and the coffee cup. I emptied the butts into the garbage bin and placed the cup and plate in the empty sink. I opened the beer. Then I was sitting on the floor, going through the CDs. I put in something I hadn't put in a very long time. Okay.